Well, it's Father's Day. And I want to preach a lesson for the fathers this morning. And that's why I asked Don to read Proverbs 31, 10 through 31. Are you scratching your heads? Well, there is method to my madness, and I will explain that shortly. It was Mother's Day a few months ago, and on that particular occasion, I preached a lesson about the worthy woman that we read about in Proverbs chapter 31. And that passage is a beautiful psalm of praise for a virtuous and worthy wife. And this psalm begins with the writer asking the question, who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. And then the writer goes on to describe this worthy woman. And I talked with you about several things from this passage just a few months ago, and pointed out to you that the writer tells us that a worthy woman is a priceless treasure. Her worth is far above rubies. She's a faithful wife. She's a willing worker, a benevolent neighbor. She's a good mother. She cares about her children and her husband. She's a wise teacher. And she's a God-fearing servant. But brothers and sisters, I believe that there is an unsung hero in this story. Someone that is usually overlooked. And so I want to talk with you this morning about the worthy woman's worthy husband. Because although it is certainly the case that he is not the focus in this passage, I think there are some things that this passage reveals about him. And so I want to take a closer look at this particular passage and point out some things from this text about the worthy woman's worthy husband. And the first thing that I want to show you is that he's a man who trusts his wife implicitly. In the 11th verse, the writer says the heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. Now, I think it's pretty obvious that the worthy woman's worthy husband trusts her because she's worthy of his trust. And so he trusts her with his good name, with his children, with his property. And he trusts her completely because she's the kind of woman who has earned that kind of trust. She gives him every reason to trust her and no reason not to. And it is certainly the case that some men do not trust their wives because their wives are not trustworthy. In the 7th chapter of the book of Proverbs, the wise man describes a woman like that. There's this young fellow walking along the way, and he is naive and oblivious to the wiles of the wicked woman, and she intercepts him, and she says, come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. he has taken a bag of money with him and will come home on the appointed day. It's obvious that that gal wasn't trustworthy. Her husband was out of town and she was up to no good. And so it's certainly the case that not every woman is trustworthy. But as I think about all of that, it occurs to me that not every husband trusts his wife, even though she gives him no reason to doubt her love and loyalty. At least that's a possibility. In fact, I just thought of this. There's a passage in the Old Testament where if a husband suspected his wife of having committed adultery, but there was no real proof of that, they could administer what we call the bitter water test. And you may remember that passage. I can't even remember the reference off the top of my head. But the priest was to prepare this water in a certain way, and she was to drink the water, and if certain things happened, then they would know she was guilty, and if they didn't happen, she would know that she wasn't. And I'm just mentioning that to illustrate the fact that in Old Testament times, evidently, God recognized the possibility that a husband might not trust his wife, might suspect her of adultery even when she wasn't guilty. You ever known any husbands like that? Don't answer that question. Just think about it. Ever known someone who's always wondering where his wife is and what she's doing and who she's doing it with and when she's coming home and how much money she's going to spend at Walmart? Have you ever known a husband like that? Have you ever known men who are secretly checking up on their wives? You ever known someone who was immediately suspicious if his wife was just a few minutes late? Have you ever known someone who gets jealous if his wife has even a casual conversation with another man? You ever known someone who becomes envious if his wife expresses any kind of admiration for another man? Have you ever known someone who has little, if any, confidence in his wife's wisdom and judgment and ability? What I'm saying to you is that the worthy woman's worthy husband wasn't like that. He was a man who trusted his wife. He had confidence in her faithfulness. You know that jealousy can destroy a marriage? It can just flat out ruin a good relationship. The wise man talks about the danger of jealousy in Proverbs chapter 27 of verse 4 when he writes, "Wrath is cruel and anger a torrent, but who is able to stand before jealousy?" And the Song of Solomon reveals in chapter 8 and verse 6, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame." If you've ever known someone who struggles with the green-eyed monster, then you can appreciate what we're saying about the worthy woman's worthy husband, because he just trusted his wife implicitly. He knew that she would be a good steward of their resources. He knew that she would take care of his children. He knew that she would be responsible with his property and his possessions, and he trusted her wisdom and her judgment and her abilities. Trust is so vitally important in any relationship, but especially in marriage. And so may I say to the fathers in this assembly, and the husbands who may not be fathers, if you want to be a worthy husband, you need to trust your wife implicitly. And then secondly, I want to suggest to you something that is not explicitly stated in this text. And I realize that I may be reading a little bit between the lines here, and that's a dangerous thing to do. But it seems to me that the point that I'm making here, that the worthy husband provides for his family, is something that's implied in this passage, even though it's not explicitly stated. Verse 23 says, "Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land." Now, I realize when you read this particular passage, it might seem that the worthy woman is the only one doing any work in that family, and that her husband is off somewhere living the life of Riley. But if we were to draw that conclusion, I think we'd be making a mistake. Because although the writer doesn't specifically mention the work of the family in this home, do you get the impression when you read this passage that he's a do-nothing dad? That he's a deadbeat father? I don't get that impression. And while the writer talks about all of the various activities of this wife and all of the things that she's doing, she's making clothing for her family, for example, turning flax into linen and various other things. Well, I would ask you, where did she get those resources? Where did that flax come from? How is she able to do all of this? Is she the only one working in the family? Well, verse 23 says that her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. Now, I think that statement tells us something about the worthy woman's worthy husband. You see, the gate in a city was not just an entrance into the city. It was that, but it was a whole lot more than that. It was a place where the citizens of that city would assemble together for various reasons. In fact, it was a place where they would conduct legal business. Remember the story of Ruth? And remember that Boaz was a near kinsman and Ruth wanted him to marry her. And he was willing to do that because he admired Ruth's wonderful qualities. But there was a problem. There was another relative that was closer, a nearer kinsman than Boaz. And that fella had the first option. And so Boaz went and talked to this fellow, and at first he was willing to redeem the land, but when he found out that a wife came with that, he wasn't willing to go that far. And so Boaz, after a ritual that they performed, he became the near kinsman. But here's my point. All of that legal business was conducted in the gate of the city. And so the gate was where people would assemble together in conference on various public affairs. The city gate was where judgment would be administered by the elders of the city. And the worthy woman's worthy husband is an elder. And you see, the elders in ancient cities, they served as local magistrates. They were involved, Zach, in bringing murderers to trial. And they were involved in administering punishment to disobedient sons. And they were involved if a man questioned whether or not the woman that he was betrothed to had remained a virgin. And as I said a moment ago, evidently the worthy woman's worthy husband was one of the elders in the city. Now, here's my question. Do you think he would have gotten to be an elder if he was a do-nothing husband and a deadbeat dad? Do you think that's the kind of fella that they would have appointed to serve in that capacity? I just don't see that, do you? And so even though the work of the husband in this household is not explicitly mentioned in the text, for the reasons that I've already offered you, it seems to me that it's implied. I don't think the worthy woman was the only one doing the work in this family. And let me remind you, the law of Moses had quite a lot to say about the importance of work. In fact, it's just commanded by the Lord. You may recall that when God gave the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai and he gave the Sabbath command, as he offered some explanation about that, we're told in Exodus 23 and verse 12, 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female servant and the stranger may be refreshed. Actually, the passage I just read is from chapter 23. I was alluding to chapter 20. But the point still stands. When God gave the Sabbath command to the Israelites, he had something to say about working for 6 days. And I'm sure that you remember, if you've ever read the book of Proverbs, that the book of Proverbs just has a lot to say about laziness. And God doesn't like it. In fact, in the 10th chapter of Proverbs, in the 4th verse, the wise man says, "He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich." In chapter 12 and verse 24, the wise man says, "The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor." Now, does that sound like the worthy woman's worthy husband to you? Doesn't sound like it to me. chapter 28 of Proverbs and verse 19. He who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows frivolity will have poverty enough. So again, I ask the question, do you suppose that the worthy woman's worthy husband would have been known as he sat among the elders in the gates if he had been a no-account lazy bum? Vita, you think he'd be that kind of guy in the gates? If he was that kind of guy, I don't think he would. And so the point that I'm making here is I just don't believe he was a deadbeat dad. He wasn't just spitting and whittling when he was sitting there in the gates. He wasn't just shooting the breeze. He was an elder doing the work of elders. Now, these aren't New Testament elders, you understand. But he was doing the work of elders in administering the affairs of a particular city. There's good reason to believe that the worthy woman's worthy husband did what Paul instructs all able-bodied men to do, and that is work. Paul told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 10, "And indeed you do so toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia, but we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more, that you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, that you may walk properly toward those who are outside and that you may lack nothing." Now, the New Testament clearly teaches that we are to be engaged in the work of the Lord, but I don't think that's what Paul's talking about here. He's talking about working with your hands to support yourself and to take care of your family and to help needy people. And no doubt you recall that in Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, Paul said that if a man will not work, what should happen? Don't answer that. Just think about the answer. What should happen for the fellow that doesn't work? Well, Paul says he shouldn't eat. May I throw something in for free that's not going to cost you anything extra? I think we'd be a whole lot better off in our society if we would apply that principle today. If a fellow won't work, he shouldn't eat, Brian. That's what Paul says. And Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 that the fellow who will not provide for his own has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. I remember Brother Dick Blackford talking about this passage many years ago, and he asked the question, what could be worse than being worse than an unbeliever? And that just kind of stuck with me. The Lord only knows the number of shiftless, irresponsible husbands who have ignored and neglected their responsibilities to take care of their families. Now, I do need to acknowledge that I'm well aware of the fact that at times there are certain circumstances beyond a man's control that may prevent him from being the breadwinner in the family. I know that can happen. Maybe because of sickness or accident or the loss of a job, many other reasons. I know there are times when a man is not able to take care of his family, and God doesn't expect a man to do something that he can't do. Paul says that in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 12 when he writes, "For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has and not according to what he does not have." Now, in that context, he was talking about giving to the Lord specifically so that the needy saints in Jerusalem could be cared for, but there's a principle there. the man who would if he could, but he can't, is blameless and he shouldn't feel guilty. Maybe I should say that again. The man who would if he could, but he can't, is blameless and shouldn't feel guilty about that. It is only the man who could if he would, but he won't, who is worthy of blame. And so to be a worthy husband, fellas, you need to provide for your family. It's the wife's primary responsibility to care for the home, and it's the husband's primary responsibility to bring home the bacon. You were supposed to smile. Now, I don't think this means that it's sinful for a wife to work outside the home. But the New Testament teaches that her primary responsibility is in the home. Well, there's a third thing that I think this text reveals about the worthy woman's worthy husband, and that is that he allows his wife to rule the household. Look at verse 27. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. I mean, all throughout this proverb, we're reading about all that the worthy woman is doing. But isn't it obvious that she is able to do that because her husband allows her to do that? While the New Testament clearly teaches that the husband is the head of his wife, it also teaches that the wife is to rule the household. Paul says in 1 Timothy 5, verse 14, "Therefore I desire that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully." Who's to manage the house? Well, Paul says it's the woman to do that. It's the wife that's to do that. Now, my point is that the worthy woman's worthy husband gives her the freedom and the authority to guide the household. Just look with me for a moment at the authority that the worthy woman wields in her home. Verse 13 tells us that she provides clothing for her family. Verse 15 says that she plans and prepares the meals. I suspect that most men would marvel if they only knew the amount of work that it takes for a woman to put food on the table every day. My wife likes to cook once or twice a week, and we eat leftovers in between. And you know something? I'm perfectly good with that. That's perfectly fine with me. Because I can vaguely remember what it was like as a bachelor when I would work all day, and then I'd come home and I'd have to put a meal on the table. I could cook a little bit. My repertoire was somewhat limited, but it was edible. But I really am thankful that I don't have to work all day and come home and put a meal on the table. I really do appreciate that. Husbands, let me ask you some questions. When you read this passage, do you get the impression that the worthy woman had to consult with her husband about every decision that was made in the home. I just don't get that impression. Does it look to you like he suffocated her with his leadership, that he made her account for every penny she spent? Do you get the impression that she was a lady of leisure, that she laid around the house all day watching soap operas with curlers in her hair? And I'm dating myself because women don't use curlers anymore. I can remember when my mama used curlers. I probably shouldn't have said that. My point is that the worthy woman's worthy husband allowed his wife the freedom and the authority to rule the household. And if you want to be a worthy husband, you need to do that too. Well, there's one last thing that I want to say about the worthy woman's worthy husband, and that is that he praised his wife. In verse 28 and 29, the writer says, "Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates." I think I said this when I preached my lesson on the worthy woman, that I just can't see this fella calling his wife the old lady. There was a fella down home when I was a kid that he did custom baling. The little round bales. Some of you remember the little round bales. And his wife was always with him. He took his wife everywhere they went. And somebody asked him, "Well, why do you take your wife with you everywhere you go?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to kiss her goodbye." Well, I don't see the worthy woman's worthy husband acting like that or saying something. I'm assuming that he was kidding. I don't see this husband ridiculing his wife in public. I don't see this husband making fun of his wife's weaknesses. I think this fellow was the kind of guy that did what Peter tells husbands to do in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. "Husbands, likewise dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." Many years ago, I read a commentator who was commenting on this passage, and he says, "That means we need to treat our wives like a Ming vase, not some old garbage can." I don't know if I would know what a Ming vase is if it was sitting right there in front of me, but I know it's expensive. You ladies probably know about Ming vases, but you need to treat your wife like a princess. So husbands, let me ask you a question. Do you regularly tell your wife that you love her? And do you thank your wife for all that she does to make a house a home? It's the woman that makes a house a home. It's not the guys. I mean, I've already told you when I was a bachelor, I had one thing hanging on my wall in my apartment, and that was a printer's tray knick-knack thing, and it was on the wall because two ladies put it there when they were kind of helping me get set up. If they hadn't done that, you think that'd been on my wall? Wouldn't have been on my wall. You know why? Well, I don't like to fill those holes when I move, you know? It's the woman who makes a house a home. May I share a short little article entitled, Taking Your Wife for Granted. One afternoon, a man came home from work to find total mayhem in his house. His three children were outside, still in their pajamas, playing in the mud with empty food boxes and wrappers strewn all around the front yard. The door of his wife's car was open, as was the front door to the house. Proceeding into the entry, he found an even bigger mess. A lamp had been knocked over, and the throw rug was wadded against one wall. In the front room, the TV was loudly blaring a cartoon channel, and the family room was strewn with toys and various items of clothing. In the kitchen, dishes filled the sink. Breakfast food was spilled on the counter. Dog food was spilled on the floor. A broken glass lay under the table, and a small pile of sand was spread by the back door. He quickly headed up the stairs, stepping over toys and more piles of clothes, looking for his wife. He was worried she may be ill or that something serious had happened. He found her lounging in the bedroom, still curled in the bed in her pajamas, reading a novel. She looked up at him, smiled, and asked how his day went. He looked at her bewildered and asked, "What happened here today?" She again smiled and answered, "You know, every day when you come home from work and ask me what in the world I did today?" "Yes," was his incredulous reply. She answered, "Well, today I didn't do it." Ingratitude's a terrible sin. You ever brag on your wife in her presence? In public? Praise is so important. The wise man says in Proverbs 12, verse 25, anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. Chapter 16, verse 24, pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. Chapter 25, verse 11, we're familiar with this one. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in network of silver. It was Mark Twain who said, "I can live two whole months on one good compliment." And isn't that the way it is? When I was at Florida College, I took a course entitled Home and Family. It was taught by Brother Roland Lewis, and we had to read a lot of outside reading if we wanted to get an A in the class. And he had a whole list of books that we could pick from. And there were several books written by a fellow named Charlie Shedd. I don't know if you remember that. Those books are probably long out of print now, which tells you something about how long ago that was. But he wrote a book called Letters to Karen and Letters to Philip, and I think another one, The Best Dad's a Good Lover, or something. I don't know. Really helpful books. And in his book Letters to Philip, he says on page 59, "You can be the leading man of her household only if she is the leading lady of your heart." The poet has said it this way: "Amid the cares of married life, in spite of toil and business strife, if you value your sweet wife, tell her so. There was a time you thought it bliss to get the favor of a kiss. A dozen now won't come amiss. Tell her so. Don't act as if she's past her prime, as though to please her were a crime. If e'er you loved her, now's the time. Tell her so. You are hers and hers alone. Well you know she's all you own. Don't wait to carve it on the stone. Tell her so. Never let her heart grow cold. Richer beauties will unfold. She is worth her weight in gold. Tell her so. Love you, sweetie. Well, I'm through. You see, I think there really are some important things we can learn about the worthy woman's worthy husband. If your life's not right with the Lord, you need to get right, and you need to get right with Him as soon as you can. And if you know what He would have you do, then we would urge you to do that. And we would be honored to assist you in any way that we can. You can respond to the gospel right now as we stand and we sing.